Can you hear me okay? Okay. So welcome. The topic of this talk is energy, or virya, the second of the five spiritual faculties, the five sacred faculties. And as Gil mentioned, these lead into each other. So in his beautiful talk last night about sadha, faith or trust or confidence, you might have even felt a little upsurge in energy, in inspiration, enthusiasm. So this is what I'll talk about today. This quality of energy, it's called virya in Pali. So first I want to just name that these five faculties work best when they're in balance with each other. So faith leads into energy, leads into mindfulness, leads into concentration or unification of the mind, which then leads to wisdom. So faith and wisdom are kind of a pair that balance each other, the first and the fifth. And energy and concentration, samadhi in Pali, they're another pair. They work to balance each other, harmonize each other. And then mindfulness is in the middle. It's just good all the time. So this is what Joseph Goldstein has to say. The five spiritual faculties, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, are our greatest friends and allies on this journey of understanding. These qualities are most powerful when they're in balance. Faith needs to be balanced with wisdom so that faith is not blind and wisdom is not shallow or hypocritical. When wisdom outstrips faith, we can develop a pattern where we know something and even know it deeply from our experience, yet do not live it. Faith brings the quality of commitment to our understanding. Energy needs to be balanced with concentration. Effort will bring lucidity, clarity, and energy to the mind, which concentration balances with calmness and depth. An unbalanced effort makes us restless and scattered, and too much concentration that is not energized comes close to torpor and sleep. Mindfulness is the factor that balances all these and is therefore always beneficial. So as we begin to tune into these natural faculties that are already here in this body, in this heart, we start to understand the way that they're interwoven, that they work together. Sayadaw Utejaniya, one of my favorite teachers, is a Burmese monk, spent many years as a layperson. He says that when the five faculties are balanced and harmonized together, then we're really meditating. We're really doing it. So there's this beautiful point that we're at now, having heard about faith, moving into energy. And Sharon Salzberg says this: it is a great turning point in our spiritual lives when we go from intellectual appreciation of a path to the heartfelt confidence that says, yes, it's possible to awaken. I can too. A tremendous joy accompanies this confidence. When we place our hearts upon the practice, the teachings come alive. That turning point, which transforms an abstract concept of a spiritual path to our own personal path, is faith. So I think she's also speaking to this energy, this tremendous joy that accompanies sadha as it arises. So virya. Virya is a Buddhist term. And many translations here, I'm translating it as energy, but also diligence, enthusiasm, effort, strength. And it can be defined as an attitude of gladly engaging in wholesome activities. So Gil said on the first night, it takes things up. It engages them, props things up even. And so energy and effort are similar, but not the same. And I want to make this distinction clear because I'm going to be talking first about virya, energy, and then how it relates to wise effort. Virya is found in many of the Buddhist lists. So it's the second of the spiritual faculties. It's also one of the seven awakening factors. It's very much related to wise effort on the Eightfold Path and the four wise efforts or samapadanas. But the difference is that energy feeds wise effort. It's what props up wise effort. It's what allows wise effort to manifest. So we'll be talking about that in a little bit. But first, virya. So virya, the root of the word is vira, and you might have heard it in yoga, Virabhadrasana 1, Virabhadrasana 2, warrior pose. So vira means warrior or heroine or hero. There's this kind of ferocity sometimes in virya, power. So its characteristic is to support martial exertion. It supports associated mental states. And its proximate cause is sada, faith, or samvega. Samvega is translated as spiritual urgency, which is the ground for arousing energy. So Ajahn Suchito in the Thai forest tradition has a wonderful definition. He says that energy is actually intelligence in the system. And so as we practice, we're learning to channel that intelligence, to unlock it in a particular way. I really love that. It's this intelligence, it's a natural force that's already here, and we're waking that up through practice. So we've almost been practicing for 2 days now, two full days. And I'm sure you've experienced all kinds of energy. Energy in the body can feel bristling, smooth, sluggish, electric, edgy. In the mind, similarly, it can feel thick or sticky, rattled, buzzing. And so as we continue to practice, we learn to tone this energy. We're harmonizing it. So it's coming into balance. And as Gil mentioned the first night, this energy is most skillful when it's held with kindness, with a lot of care. You could say that this kind of warmth is what tones the energy, smooths it, allows it to flow. So much of the path is learning to harmonize this, to walk a middle way between too much exertion and a kind of indolence or complacency. And even in hearing the small groups meeting with you these past 2 days, we've been talking about this territory. We know some of us have a tendency to push, to strive, to overdo it. And we get all worn out. So we're learning to work with the energy, this natural intelligence of the system to sustain. Sayadaw Utijaniya says, Be calm, be cool, and be interested. And so when we bring these elements of samadhi to concentration, calm to energy, balance comes. So Edward Conze says, their balance and harmony, this is energy and concentration, it's almost as important as the virtues themselves. They support each other to some extent, but they also stand in each other's way. So energy sometimes is used to correct the excess of concentration. And in the same way, concentration must come to the rescue of the latent faults of vigor. When vigor and energy have it all their own way, tranquility is in danger. And we all know people with a large dash of adrenaline in their blood, who are always busy, perhaps even madly efficient, but not particularly restful. Vigor by itself leads to excitement and has to be controlled by a development of concentrated calm. So I recognize myself in this description. I definitely tend towards an excess of energy, madly efficient, dashing around, lots of adrenaline. This is just my constitution. And so learning the benefit of, oh, how does the energy feel when it's smoothed out? When there's a pausing, when there's a willingness to calm. So I think it's interesting that as I'm giving this talk here in Oregon, we're having a huge windstorm. Very windy, it's blowing snowflakes all around. That's rattling the windows here. And just before, I was out for a walk in the wind and just feeling the energy, the natural force of air. And I was thinking about, in preparing this talk, I was thinking about how there's so much energy, unbridled energy in nature. We see it in the snow falling into rivers that become gushing torrents in the spring. Hopefully here that will happen. We see it in the blazing fires that so many of us have experienced these past years. I had the great good fortune of living in Hawaii for a year last year. And there's so much energy there, just in the ocean, and the crashing waves, and the wind, and the downpours of rain, and the great soaring mountains, the bright sun. It's a lot of energy in nature. And interestingly, different cultures, I think, relate to these energies. Many indigenous peoples, they know the importance of the elemental energies, how to honor them and work with them. I've traveled a bit and taught some in Iceland. And my friend, Christine from Iceland, she's an ecologist, and we did some workshops with her learning about the ecology of Iceland and meditating out in natural environments. And we would go to these very extreme places right on the shore where it's very windy and cold in Iceland and very harsh, a lot of lava and rock around. And she would sit up on these precipices and she'd say, just feel the power in the wind and bring it into your body. Let it feed you. And it was such an interesting relationship to the power of the wind, because so often I feel averse, like, oh, it makes me feel rattled inside, it's hard, want protection from the wind. But the sense of turning toward and embracing, opening to, this can also be part of our practice. So beautiful, really. So this from T.S. Eliot. Music heard so deeply that is not heard at all. But you are the music while the music lasts. And I think this speaks to the natural force of virya in us, deep in us. And when we feel it, it feels impersonal. It's not really ours, and yet you are the music while the music lasts. I think this is the dance of energy in our bodies. And when we come to observe it and work with it and flow with it, it can be a beautiful doorway into letting go. So just one more image of energy before we talk about balancing it. There's this beautiful text from the early Buddhist canon. It's called The Questions of King Milinda. And this is actually quite interesting because it's this text is apparently the product of the encounter of two great civilizations. So King Milinda was actually a Greek king. So he represents Hellenistic Greece, and he was in conversation with Nagasena, who was a very renowned elder monk. So this particular conversation is said to have happened in ancient Afghanistan, which at that time was Greece. So King Milinda is asking Nagasena all these questions. He's asking about these dilemmas raised in Buddhist philosophy, and Nagasena's answers are just delightful. Full of wit and helpful analogies and lots of similes. So in one of these sections of the questions of King Milinda, he's asking about the five spiritual faculties. And he asks for a simile for each one. So the simile for faith is someone jumping into a river with the trust and confidence that they can swim across. And the simile for energy goes like this. The king asked, "What is the mark of vigor or energy?" Nagasena says, "Vigor props up. And when propped up by vigor, all the wholesome dharmas do not dwindle away." King Milinda says, "Give me a simile." And Nagasena says, "If a man's house were falling down, he would prop it up with a new piece of wood. And so supported, that house would not collapse." So I find this image of the propping up with virya, it's very helpful. We're propping up wisdom, propping up wise effort. So I've talked a bit about the importance of balancing energy. And so I want to talk about just some ways that have been useful for me, what I've learned. Still definitely working on this. So for those of us in the West, raised in dominant Western culture, actually I'm curious to ask Nolita about this because I think perhaps South African culture is a little different, but in our Western dominant culture here, we learn to exert energy in a particular way. And for myself, I've been calling this the business model, where we're trained in school that we work hard, we exert a lot of energy, we strive and test and achieve and succeed, and we're always encouraged to push and push and push. And we're goal-oriented. It's important to know your objectives, your goals, and then what is it going to take to get there? And just so much exertion, right? This is our cultural conditioning, at least for me, raised in dominant culture. And interestingly, when we come to the cushion, we start to meditate. Maybe you've seen this model come to play. Okay, I'm sitting down. I know what I need to do. I know I need to focus on the breath. And so I'm going to do it. I'm going to really be there for every single breath. I'm going to be focused. I'm going to build concentration. It's all going to go. And we bring this striving energy. Even if we know better, we've heard, okay, 1,000 times, relax, relax. But these patterns are so deep. We find all the subtle layers of striving, pushing, of thinking, this is me doing this thing, getting concentrated, getting liberated. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. So this is very common that I see in my own mind for me. Very, very common. I always think of this as one of my favorite suttas, so I'll explain. I think actually it's not just in Western culture that we had this striving, because we hear about this in the story of Rohitasa. So this is Anguttara Nikaya 4.45, Rohitasa Sutta. And I love this sutta because it starts, it says, this brilliant being came to the Buddha in the middle of the night. And said this being was a child of the Devas and had had many different lives before. And so this being asks the Buddha, can I reach the end of suffering by traveling? And the Buddha says, no, you can't reach the end of suffering by traveling. And this being says, oh, you're so wise. You're so right. Because in one of my past lives, I was this sort of energetic, quirky, bright, kind of sprightly being named Rohitasa. And I think of Rohitasa as kind of like Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Maybe even gender non-conforming. Like, I don't think they fit in a gender binary, Rohitasa. They have a lot of energy. They're running around. They have a lot of just brightness, enthusiasm, even maybe a lot of energy or effort, virya. And this Rohitasa was one of these blessed skywalkers. Let's see, what's the phrase exactly? Powerful skywalker. And this being says, my speed was as fast as that of a strong archer, well-trained, shooting like a light arrow across the shadow of a palm tree. My stride stretched as far as the east sea is from the west. To me, endowed with such speed, such a stride, he traveled, or they traveled, all around the earth. They could travel, they tried to travel to the end of the cosmos. Spent 100 years traveling. And of course, they're kind of honest. They say, well, I had to pause to eat, had to pause to go to the bathroom, but I traveled a lot still, really fast, kept going. I was fighting off weariness, so much effort. This reminds me of me running around in circles. But then this being says, but without reaching the end of the cosmos, I died along the way. And so the Buddha says, yes, you're right. It's true. It's not possible to reach the end of suffering through traveling. And here's the clincher, which I think is so beautiful. The Buddha says, the world, Rohitasa, the world, the beginning of the world, the end of the world, the cause of this world, all of it, the beginning of suffering, the end of suffering, all of it is in this fathom-long body with its sensations, perceptions, cognition. The whole world is right here. So isn't that ironic that this being just spent hundreds of years circling the globe, traveling, perhaps even across the universes, only to hear the Buddha say, it's right here in this fathom-long body what you are searching for. Gil kind of said that to us today, didn't he? The importance of staying right here in your body, you'll learn everything you need. Such a good antidote to that running around frantically, isn't it? So my first Buddhist teacher was Pema Chodron, the great American nun in the tradition, Tibetan tradition. She says, it's helpful to realize that this very body we have, that's sitting right here, right now, with all its aches and pleasures, is exactly what we need to be fully human, fully awake, and fully alive. And when I read that from her at 19 years old, there was something that just deeply resonated. Like, oh, this is what I've been looking for in running all these marathons. I was very active in college. Marathon runners, century bike rides, all these crew races, very intense. I was just driving myself into the ground. Straight A student on all the clubs, all the activities. This is the conditioning I had. It's like, this is what it looks like to succeed. And when I read that as a freshman in college, it was like, oh, maybe I can give myself permission to just stop. Even for a moment. For many years, I'll tell you this. I would wake up in the morning, I would put on all my running clothes, and I would sit. Because it was sort of like I was afraid that I wouldn't run. So I had to get all ready. But first, I would meditate, and then I would go for my run. So it's always a balancing act. I still do that sometimes. I still get way too much energy. I'm very much striver, for sure. Have to be reminded to slow down because I talk too fast. But as we can continue on the path, we learn the sweetness of calm. We learn what it means to actually relax the mind. Sometimes it feels so foreign and surprising when that happens. Oh, peace. This rare experience that I'm having right now. And there's a kind of delight that comes. It's real permission to relax. For years, my practice was in a hammock because I needed to really like have my body fully held so that I could remember to relax deeply. Trust and trust. That's that sadha, that faith. Sayadaw Ujjayiniya has been a really beautiful reminder teacher in that for me, because he's so emphasizing always the importance of relaxing. Be calm, be cool, be interested. So he says, right now, are you aware of your posture? Are you aware of your hands? Can you feel your feet? Notice how little energy you need to know any of this. And this is all the energy you need to remain aware. But remember that you need to do this all day long. So that's the continuity of mindfulness. That as we are learning to tone this energy, we see, oh, it's not in bits and starts, fits and starts of like super energy on the cushion and then flopping back in a break. It's more the sustaining. What kind of energy does it take to smooth out, to connect moment by moment by moment of mindfulness? This is the way that our momentum grows. Such important practice at home to be in the betweens, in between postures, staying aware, moving at the pace of awareness, of mindfulness. Bringing your continuity to cooking and eating and cleaning. So often when I read these quotes from Sayadaw Ujjayiniya, I think of this metaphor, this analogy. In many Latin American countries, I think in Brazil, in Colombia, Guatemala, other places, you'll see kids perhaps playing this game. Maybe some of you have seen this. They'll have a rubber tire, kind of a loose rubber tire, and they use a stick to push the tire along to keep it rolling. Right? Does this ring a bell for anyone? This image? And the kind of the fun of the game, I think, is learning the right pressure of the stick. So you don't push too hard and the wheel wobbles all around. You get it just right, just matching the momentum, the tempo of the wheel to keep it turning. And often that might be a softer push than we think. That's very much like this balance of energy I'm talking about. A relaxed continuity. So another concept that I found very useful in this practice of conserving energy, is called kuleana in Hawaiian. So when we lived there, we heard very often this phrase of like, oh, it's not your kuleana. Kuleana means responsibility. And so it's pointing to the ways that we actually take responsibility for things that aren't ours. And this encouragement always, just stay with your own kuleana. And in my practice, this is what I've noticed is that so often when I'm taking responsibility for things I don't have control over. I get very anxious, right? And then energy is out of balance. So at the beginning of this pandemic, living here in my hometown in Ashland, I live about just a 10-minute walk from my parents. My parents are 75 and 89. They're elderly, but in very good shape. They're healthy. They're good. But wow, when the pandemic hit, I was anxious. So scared for them. So worried that somehow they were going to catch it. I ran around town trying to figure out ways so they didn't have to go anywhere, shopping for them, bought them all these masks. And it was interesting, our conversations, because they would hear me out, you know, my rules. I went over there and said, okay, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't go to the gym, you can't go shopping. Overly anxious. They would hear me out in very patient, calm ways. Okay, okay, all right, you can shop for us. But over time, I've seen that I was really overexerting myself. And they're grown-ups, they're adults, they're kuleana to find out, figure out how they're going to quarantine. And I could, of course, let my opinion be known, but then let it go. Not my kuleana, actually. And there was actually a good, great rush of energy when I realized, okay, this is where my responsibility can end. And then I can just take care of this. What's here? This kuleana. My body, balancing of these energies, my intentions, placing a lot of energy, wise effort into my intentions. So also in Hawaii, they have this beautiful way of dividing up the land. So traditionally, they would make these slices of the pie that ran from the mountaintop, the mauna, all the way down to the sea, the moana. But the slice of pie, and each family was responsible for one slice. It's called an ahupua'a. And this responsibility of each family was to steward the land, to make sure everything was in harmony there, just in their own ahupua'a. And I love that because I think it's also speaking to this, okay, I know what plot of land is my responsibility. And just here, I'm going to take care of the ecology, make sure it's in balance, that the humans living there were in balance with the other natural forces of the ecosystem. So in working with energy, knowing what is my ahupua'a, it is this little slice of land that I can help to balance and harmonize. Very good practice, I think. I'm telling lots of stories from Hawaii in this talk, and I know actually that several of you are surfers. So I'm going to talk about surfing now. And I actually do think that surfers are masters of energy. I think they very much know how to harness it in a good way. So this was not the case for me. I had the great fortune of getting surfing lessons in Hawaii, but didn't know anything about it before I moved there. And so it went with just a lot of energy. And I think just because the waves are crashing and there's already a lot of natural birria around, the tendency to just work so hard, often against the tide, so hard, over-efforting, over-exerting myself. I was a little bit of a hot mess as a beginner surfer. But it became so gratifying when I started to learn to read the water. And I could watch the swells coming and understand how strong or big those waves were going to be. And then the secret to catching the waves wasn't actually just paddling like my life depended on it, but knowing the timing. And just right at the right moment, just a couple of strokes, and my board would catch. And then it was just grace, just pure grace, the wave pushing me into shore. This is very much like practice. As we continue, we refine our ability to read the energies, to know when it takes just a little push, you know, a couple of hard strokes, and then, oh, we can just relax back on our board, trust the momentum. So this can be a good barometer for you. Look at, okay, how is my energy level? How am I exerting it? How am I relaxing back? Sometimes relaxing is the skillful response. Sometimes efforting is the skillful response. And surfing, it can be quite scary to just let go and let the force of the ocean take you. This is true also in practice. It can be kind of startling and like a free fall. It can feel like, okay, I'll try. We're often working with a lot of ambiguity, trusting our own intuition. We don't always get what we expect. So, practice instructions from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who is a great Dzogchen master. This is what he says. The everyday practice is simply to develop a complete acceptance and openness to all situations and emotions and to all people, experiencing everything totally without mental reservations and blockages, so that one never withdraws or centralizes into oneself. This produces a tremendous energy, which is usually locked up in the process of mental evasion and a general running away from life experiences. So in this process of understanding our kulyana, letting go of all the rest, letting go of the extraneous, focusing in on what we really can take responsibility for, we fully open to our physical sensations as we're practicing. We open to our emotions, our mental states, open to other people. It releases all these reserves of energy that are stored deep inside us, this natural force. It releases all this energy because we're so often putting energy into becoming and striving, self-referentiality. It's all about me all the time. We start to open in this radical way, being curious about others, about our own really reality or what's happening. It releases all these storages of energy. Quite beautiful. So when this energy is released, we might notice, oh, we have a lot of strength, actually. Quite a lot of power in this heart and in this mind, in this body. And we need this power to walk the path. Because as you know, it's not easy. So this is a poem that's been inspiring me lately. I think it really speaks to the kind of endurance, the ferocity even, the heroic energy that we need. Not a pushing, but a powerful kind of energy. So this poem is called Longing by Julie Cadwallader Staub. And she's talking about this bird, this tiny bird called the Black Pole Warbler. Maybe some of you are birders, you know about the Black Pole Warbler. I didn't know until I read this poem. And so she says, consider the Black Pole Warbler. She tips the scales at 1 ounce, 1 ounce, before she migrates, taking off from the seacoast to our east, flying higher and higher, ascending 2 or 3 miles during her 80 hours of flight, until she lands in Tobago, north of Venezuela, 3 days older and weighing half as much. She flies over open ocean almost the whole way. Oh, she's not so different from us. The arc of our lives is a mystery too. We do not understand. We cannot see what guides us on our way, that longing that pulls us toward the light. Not knowing, we fly onward, hearing the dull roar of the waves below. So that is some kind of energy, isn't it? All packed into this 1 ounce bird. She flies for 3 days straight and shows up half an ounce, half her body weight. Can you imagine? My friend, another Dharma teacher, who I dearly beloved friend, Tuere, she teaches from this poem. She says, you know, if that was us, that bird, we would be complaining the whole way through. All those 3 days, we'd be complaining and groaning. It's too hard. It's so hard. I can't do it. I can't do it. Sometimes we feel like that in the cushion, don't we? Have you felt that way a little bit these first 2 days? But consider the black pole warbler. That's the natural force that we all have. And we're capable of great things. So much more than we even know when we unlock these stores of energy. Not really us. We start to see, oh, it's just nature. We're not doing the work, but we're setting the conditions so the work unfolds. So certain conditions, I think, that can bring up this kind of energy are simplicity. And you've seen this as you've carved out the time, made space in your schedule this week of practice, simplifying your schedule, very helpful for freeing up energy. Renunciation, letting go of what's extra. Very important, I would say. And then contemplating impermanence. This is very important for energy to arise. And we've done a little bit already, just recognizing how precious this opportunity is. It's fleeting. We don't know the next time we'll get it. Not just that these retreats at IRC are very popular and they fill right up and you have to get on a waiting list and it's hard to get in. Not that, but what are all the other conditions in your life that have to align to be able to do this? Many freedoms and opportunities. Not everybody has them. So when we consider, oh, so brief, this time I have to practice, I'm aging, I don't know how long I have actually. It brings a great samvega, spiritual urgency, which then alights energy. Okay, so I promised I would get to the four right efforts, and here we are. So just this last portion, I want to talk about the samapadanas, the four wise efforts. And I will tell you actually that sometimes when I hear this teaching, it feels a little forceful and striving. So we hear the faculty of energy and strength. This is here, I'll read this from the Samyutta Nikaya. Here, a noble disciple dwells as one who has produced strength for the abandoning of unskillful dhammas and the arousing of skillful dhammas. They are firm, this noble disciple. They are firm of steady valor, not relinquishing their purpose with regard to skillful dhammas. And again, in the suttas, they say, in respect of the four right efforts, this is where the faculty of energy or strength is seen. So energy props up the wise efforts, these four. But they can sound like there's a lot of doing here. And I just want to say, this is a little paradoxical. Because as we continue to practice with these, wisdom is actually what does it. So it's less about us learning what to cultivate, what not to cultivate, and doing all this stuff. It's more like trusting the process, balancing your energy, channeling it, toning it, harmonizing it. And then wisdom comes in and understands, oh, this is what I can abandon. This is what I can cultivate. So these wise efforts are actually very important in the path. So there's four of them. The Reverend Leanne in the Soto Zen tradition uses a helpful acronym. So I'm going to teach this acronym. It's PACE, P-A-C-E. So PACE stands for, the P is prevention, A is abandoning, C is cultivating, and E is extending or expanding. And so we pace ourselves with care. We hold all this with a lot of kindness. We notice, okay, if this gets to be too much striving, you can rest back and trust. Oh, this is the process of practice, that this happens naturally. So the first one, prevention, preventing, this is knowing how to prevent unskillful states from arising. And we only know this through making mistakes. So if we stay up too late, we push ourselves too hard, like me running all these marathons, we learn, okay, that actually brought about a lot of unskillful states, harming my own body, pushing myself too hard, grumpiness with others. We see, oh, when we push this way, it's not skillful. And so over time, we learn to not even do those things at all, to prevent those harmful mental states, actions from arising. So a year ago, my partner and I took semi-monastic vows. We were anagarikas for a year. And during that time, didn't listen to music, didn't wear jewelry, didn't watch any movies. And when our 12 months were up, we gave back those monastic vows and I watched a movie or two. And I'll tell you, I saw movies for this heart and mind create a lot of anxiety. Even Disney movies, I can barely watch them. It's so much anxiety that comes. Especially in the evening, I will not sleep if I watch a movie. So just knowing this is what's true for this being might change over time, but so sensitive that actually I really am not watching movies, preventing that energy of anxiety, of uptightness from arising. I'm just saying for this one, not across the board for everybody. But that's been an interesting observation is, oh, I can actually soothe myself, go to bed early, not even worry if I don't watch a movie. Way more easeful. Prevention. This often happens, I think, with social media too. If you're anything like me, social media can bring up a lot of unskillful mental states. Doom scrolling, just greed, aversion, delusion, confusion, is a whole heyday there. So knowing that, having seen that a bunch, I really don't doom scroll anymore. I just know if I do that, I will be unhappy. Don't do it. Prevention. Okay, so A, abandoning. This is when difficult states have arisen, unskillful mental states. This is how we know how to let them go, how to abandon them. And this is very much in the territory of the hindrances. You know, we're on second day of retreat. The hindrances have been arising, I'm sure. The nivaranas, the hindrances of desire and aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry and doubt. So when these arise, this is maybe a little counterintuitive, but instead of trying to just abandon them right away, like no doubt, no sloth and torpor, no, trying to cut them out, you've probably seen that doesn't work so well. So abandoning actually means perhaps first embracing, turning towards, feeling them in your body, allowing them. For example, rage. And I'm not usually an angry person, but I'll tell you this last year, I've had quite a big dose of rage come up around certain political situations. So rage is like a fire burning, right? When it arises, it feels like it could just light the whole place, bonfire everywhere. And interestingly, we've had them, haven't we? I live here in Ashland, the Talent Phoenix fire that burned in early September, it started 2 miles from where we live. So it's just that raging, out of control fire. How do we work with this? How do we abandon it? Well, I'll say rage actually can be skillfully managed through a controlled burn. So up in the hills now in the parks in Ashland, they're doing all these controlled burns. They're gathering wood, firewood, burning just enough so that it burns the excess tinder kindling and keeps the fires healthy. So with a hindrance like rage, a strong emotion like rage or fear, can we allow a controlled burn? So actually that energy gets channeled into mindfulness. Oh, I'm with this. I'm really curious about this. And over time, the story loses its grip. And then we're just with the sheer sensations of the emotion. Then it becomes fuel for our practice, good fertilizer. And we learn, okay, I can let this go. We learn to abandon it over time with patience at its own pace. Abandoning. Cultivation. This is a fun one, right? We've seen when we practice metta, we cultivate kindness, cultivate compassion. What are the circumstances, the conditions that grow these wholesome states? For me, it's going out in nature for sure. finding spiritual friends who have a lot of wholesome qualities. Isn't it true when we're around our teachers and our Kalyanamitas, our friends, we're inspired by their good qualities. Generosity grows, gratitude grows. So creating the conditions to water the seeds of goodness and cultivating the garden. And then expanding and extending. So when joy arises, how do we expand it? Often it's when we share it, practicing mudita. We learn the activities that help us really expand our joy, expand our love, our compassion. Brahma Vihara is this to me feels like the most skillful response these days. Brahma Viharas are the divine abodes, metta, kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. One of my teachers, Martin Aylward, says the Brahma Viharas are the natural resting place of the undefended heart. So we share our goodness with others. And all the while, we're watering the seeds that are already here, knowing that we're already enough. We're just growing the wisdom that knows how to cultivate what's here. And the good news is, as we cultivate this energy, we practice the wise efforts, mindfulness is what comes next. It's the third spiritual faculty, and mindfulness will help us with these. So it's this ever-growing, deepening sense of presence, of wisdom, of trust. Energy feels calm and smooth. So these five faculties feed each other. They balance each other. So beautiful. Okay, my friends. So let's just finish here with a poem. And this is a poem called Be the Energy by Dana Falls. Trust the energy that courses through you. Trust. Then take surrender even deeper. Be the energy. Don't push anything away. Follow each sensation back to its source and focus your awareness there. Be the ecstasy. Be unafraid of consummate wonder. Emerge so new, so vulnerable that you don't know who you are. Be the energy, and paradoxically, be at peace. Dare to be your own illumination and blaze a trail across the clear night sky. Blaze a trail across the clear night sky. So let's just sit for a moment or two, letting the words settle into silence. Thank you for your kind attention. I just have several announcements about this schedule. So this evening, we'll have our first optional practice discussion. And if you're interested in coming, you're welcome to come. We'll just be talking about the Dharma, maybe answering any questions or sharing. So that's at 7:15. And there's a link to that particular, there's a special open practice discussion room. And that link is found in your schedule. So that's at 7:15 this evening. For those in different time zones, we'll have another one of these optional practice discussion at 5:30 in the morning Pacific time tomorrow. So Nolita will be up early for that open practice discussion at 5:30 Pacific in the morning. Then tomorrow, the 5:30 open practice discussion, 6 a.m. sit as usual. At the 8:30 session tomorrow, we'll be having a Dharma talk. Nolita will give a talk at 8:30 tomorrow in the morning. And then also tomorrow afternoon, we'll have a pain and posture clinic at 2:45 during the walking session. So I believe there's an announcement posted about that and the location of that pain and posture clinic happening at 2:45 tomorrow afternoon. So I think those are all the announcements. And I wish you a really wonderful continuation of your wise effort and your virya, your energy. Perhaps it's dinner time for some of you. Perhaps it's bedtime. Just continue in your own way, trusting the practice. Okay. We'll see you again soon. Be well.